if you were well spoken in German, you were asked to be part of the escape committee that contacted guards that were amenable to bribery with Canadian or British cigarettes, and this type of trading went on with guards that they could blackmail, like they might, if he was a bit careless, for instance, the photographer, the camp photographer who would come in to photograph an escape tunnel, if he was a bit careless and left his camera, somebody would wipe it. And in order for him to get it back so that he wasn't posted to the Russian front, they would have him then. And he would have to, they were very, very clever at it. I admire some of those men, and they were absolutely marvelous at this work. I had no language or anything, and I was a pharmacy apprentice before the war. And when I found that I couldn't, I really felt myself getting mentally poor mentally. A poor mental attitude. I went on sick break, and I went over to the hospital, and I asked, I told the medical officer I wasn't sick or anything. I just felt that I'd like to do something. Could I go to work in the hospital? And as it turned out, there was the people in the lab were sick at the time, and they said they would teach me the lab routine. And so I worked in the hospital then for from October 43 till July 44.
July 44,
we were chased out of there by the Russians. The Russian army was advancing through Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia down that East Baltic coast. So they wanted this camp as a camp for troops, German troops, and they moved us out. And the one lager, K lager, and the four lager. The four lager consisted of the Red Cross people, the Red Cross stores, and the hospital, and the sick personnel. Were moved out, and we went to Memel by train, and from Memel we went on a collier across the Baltic. I think it was 3 days, and we weren't fed, and we weren't allowed up. The overcrowding was pretty bad.
Conditions being fairly atrocious, I would imagine.
Yeah, they were pretty bad. And we got off at Schwingenlinde, and at Schwingenlinde we were handcuffed together and our shoes taken, and we were put in half a boxcar, which was screened off, and the guard was in the other half with an automatic weapon of some sort. Schmeiser, I guess it was. And about the time we were loaded, the air raid sirens went, and there was one of the pocket battleships, I don't know which one, was tied up alongside where we were being loaded onto the trains, and we thought that they were going to bomb that, and it turned out it was an American diversionary air raid, and as soon as it was over, the train took off, and by a very circuitous route, we went to Stalag Loft 4, although we didn't know it at the time. When we got there, they gave us our boots, and it was at a rail junction called Kiefheide. And as we were getting out, you could hear a lot of noise and shouting and screaming and dogs barking, and it began to get a little concerned as to what was going on, because it was a little bit abnormal. And as we came around the end of the railway station, we found out why. What they were doing was starting the people off walking, and then attacking them with bayonets and rifle butts and dogs. And in the event, we ran up 3 kilometers to an open field where the camp was. And I didn't know it at the time, but I have since heard that there were machine gunners in the woods ready to cut down anybody.
Any stragglers or any...
Big person.
Ready to cut down any stragglers or
any people. Well, the people, some people, I can remember seeing one fellow being beaten with rifle butts. He couldn't run any further, and he was in a ditch, and they were beating him with rifle butts.
Would this be caused at all? I don't know if you can recall, or you know, even at this time, whether or not you were too interested, but. Would the behavior of the German guards at this time be somewhat predicated on the fact that the Russians were literally...
I don't think so.
I mean, did you sort of get the impression at all that the Germans were seeing the writing on the wall, so to speak?
No, I think what caused it in this particular case, we found out afterwards, this was what was called a Straflager. Straf means to punish. It was a punishment camp for terror fleeers. They always referred to bomber crews as terror fleeers because the bombing was beginning to hurt, and the American bombing was getting very heavy. And at this time, you can imagine they were laying on 1,000 bomber raids, and they were burning cities, and the bombing was beginning to be very noticeable, and I think that's what caused it. In any case, we were left out in the field with no medical. The doctor couldn't do much because he didn't have anything, but he did the best he could. And the Germans wouldn't supply anything. And after, I think, a day or 2 days, they finally gave us some tents. And we were in there for a day or so, and then we were put into the main camp. But to get in there, you have to go through a gauntlet of 10 men on either side, and they bayoneted you and beat you with rifle butts as you went in.
Mm-hmm.
When you got in, there was a strip search, very thorough, and they confiscated almost everything. Anything you had managed to bring up without throwing it away on the road when you were run up, they confiscated watches, pens, personal letters, photographs. In fact, I can recall one fellow, all he had was his shorts when they finished with him. And one of the guards broke the foot of one of our fellows because he put his foot up on the bench to tie his shoe. And he broke his foot with a rifle. But this time, they were a bit mad, I think.
So the Stalagluft 4 was, in essence, in a special camp strictly for the bomber pilots. I'm just wondering, in comparison to the previous camp, number 3,
Luft 6, you mean?
Or Luft 6.
We came from Luft 6, I really don't know. You see, K-Logger was mostly American airmen, And this was mostly an American camp at that time, and I think we got in it to make up some numbers. It's hard to say. And in any case, we got in there, and the barracks were all full, and they were building a new compound. And normally, they would try and separate the RAF, and we were part of the RAF at that time, from the Americans. And we were put into an American compound, but they didn't have proper barracks for us, and they had built some little huts. We called them dog kennels. And we were in there, we only got, the meals were very bad there. We got no Red Cross parcels, and one meal a day.
Were the Americans singled out at this time a little bit because of the fact that they...
I think they were, yes.
Yeah.
I believe they were. Then by, when was it, about August, no, that was July, August, September, I guess the other compound was ready, in a sort of a way, and they moved us out. I think there were 900 RAF people went into the compound, and it was almost Christmas before things sorted themselves out, where we got, we had no, nothing for the stoves, for instance, anyway, I finally, they got organized pretty well again. I got back working in the hospital, but that didn't last very long because they evacuated the camp in late January, and we went
Which
on the road.
Which is now January 1945 now.
We're 45, up there. Yeah. And we went on the road in 45, in January. And you had no idea where you were going. I don't think they knew either.
Mm-hmm.
And you were just, we were informed around midnight. And we had to decide what we were going to take. And we had to sew up some sort of a knapsack to carry it in. And they opened the stores department, and anybody who needed new boots or socks or a greatcoat or anything, gloves, were given, so that we got all American shoes. And anyway, we went on the road. It was very cold, and we slept in the fields in the snow, and or in a barn if they could find one. And you stole stuff to eat, and everybody got dysentery after about 3 weeks from eating frozen turnips and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us, there were quite a few, got so ill that they finally convinced the Jerrys to give us some wagons. And the whole column then looked like all the pictures you've ever seen of refugees. You know,
mm-hmm.
And everybody had this terrible dysentery. Some people, we had several people die of pneumonia. And
I guess at this point, we're into February, March 1945, and with the Russians not too far behind, I guess the Germans are more concerned at this point about their own survival, and really the prisoners at this point were pretty low down on the priority list.
Well, they were totally, and you were on secondary or tertiary roads, so that because they were moving Volkssturm up to the front.
Which is people's militias, I guess.
Volkssturm were old men over the age of... over the service age, and children,
mm-hmm.
you know, really 12, 14 year olds, and they were hopeless.
Sure.
And one amusing thing there, if you'd like to hear it, was that
sure, of course.
We passed, we were marching west, and there was a column of German soldiers, I guess they had cleaned out a bunch of the barracks, and they were marching them east. And in the German army, there were singing masters, and they used to say, Eins, zwei, drei, sing, and they all had to sing. And so as our column, I guess they wanted to show us that their morale was up, when they got opposite us, they had moved us off the road, and they were marching on the road, and the singing master got out there, and Eins, zwei, drei, sing, and they started to sing, and the song they sang was, We Are Marching Against England. And everybody said, yelled at them, you're going the wrong way. So, I'd repeat it. Anyway.
I imagine you had one very angry sing master.
Yeah. And we, a bunch of us then were taken off the road and put into Stalag 2A at Neubrandenburg.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the, that would be in March, so late March, I guess. And on the 29th of April, the Russian army relieved us, and we were with them for about 2 weeks.
Did you have any fears in those last few days or even hours before relief by the Russians that the Germans would massacre the prisoners or?
I understand, I never saw it, but I understand that from history books that Hitler had given orders that all prisoners were to be shot. And the German army they observed, in the main, they observed the Geneva Convention, and they simply didn't do it. They simply wouldn't do it.
Sort of a case where they're Germans first and then maybe Nazis second.
Yeah,
all,
I think so, yes. They simply wouldn't do it, that's mm-hmm. all. And it was a pretty lively night, the night we were relieved, but...
How did it come about? Did the Germans just literally melt away in the face of the Russians?
They asked for the senior men, and when you were in a camp, each nationality had a leader that they appointed, or he was a senior rank in most cases, and he would liaise between the men and the German command. And in this particular case, the German commandant, we could hear the firing. You could see that the local airport was on fire and they were blowing up aircraft and one thing and another.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew that it was only a matter of hours. And at 12 o'clock at noon, they asked all the senior men to go for a conference with the Germans. And the commandant said, we're evacuating the camp. All Germans were leaving the camp, and you can go or stay, and we must have your answer within an hour. Our British man then came back from this conference with the German authorities, and they he called everybody together and told us what they had said, and by a show of hands, we voted to stay. And some of the Central Europeans, I think, left, but it was a huge camp with many nationalities.
Many nationalities.
I think almost all of them stayed. And
sort of trusting in the good graces of the Russians.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the event, the Germans left about early in the afternoon. They just walked away, and we were left there. So they formed work parties to make red crosses out of blankets and things for putting on the roofs so that Russian aircraft wouldn't bomb the place or shoot it up. And they wrote in with the cutouts of blankets and so on, they wrote POW and KGF for Kriegsgefangene. And by midnight that same day, things got very noisy, and Russian tanks came through and smashed down the wire, and we had taken shelter. There were a lot of shooting going on, and we took shelter in the air raid trenches, and when it began to get light, around 4 or 5 o'clock, we came out, and the Russians were in control. And they called us together that late that afternoon, I guess. And there was a, I don't know what he was, a commissar perhaps, a political officer, I suppose.
The commissar,
and
yeah.
He could speak excellent English, and he told us that we would be fed and looked after, and we were allowed to go outside the camp up to about 10 kilometers, but we were to stay within a reasonable distance, waiting for the process of turning us over to our own people.
And in general, how would you describe your treatment at the hands of the Russian troops?
In that particular camp, it was excellent. I understand that in other camps it could be very bad. In our place, they actually put on shows on the side of the building. I remember one was Sonia Heaney. And and our barracks were so bad with bed bugs and lice, and they deloused us, and they moved us out and into a permanent structure down the road, an old Panzer caserna, and they fed us soup and bread, which is what their own troops got, and really we had no quarrel with them at all. They treated us very well, and then one day, we had been there, I guess, about 2 weeks, I think. Jeep drove in with our RCAF squadron leader and our corporal driver, and he said, we're going to get you home, and he went and talked to the German, or the Russian commandant, and the very next morning we were loaded on trucks and taken to the American lines. The Americans then drove us to the British lines at Lunenburg Heath, and there we were deloused again. We were all terribly lousy, and in fact I think we were deloused 3 times in 2 days, which is a lot of DDT. Then they gave us new clothing, they burned all our clothing, and the very next day they flew in a bunch of Lancasters, loaded us on, and we went back to England.
For, I guess, the debriefing, amongst other things.
Well, we landed at Ford Aerodrome, and they drove us by truck, the Canadians. These were mostly British people that I was with at this time, and they went to their own place. I was, myself and one other fellow, were driven to Bournemouth, And there we were fed beautifully. We could eat. They opened up, they had a special mess for returning prisoners of war. And you could, it was open 24 hours a day. And food and milk and everything was unlimited. You could go any time of the day or night and eat as much or as little as you liked. And then we went to debriefing and an interrogation. And
what exactly was the debriefing?
Well, it was, I think it was simply a sort of thing, how did you get shot down? How did you lose your aircraft? Were you well treated? That sort of thing. And then our personal belongings were brought up from stores. They all went into stores when we were shot down. And we then were given leave. And
well, it was very much a matter of routine, basically, just picking up loose ends. And
that's right.
Yeah.
Then I was recalled. I met my navigator there, and I went to see the skipper's father, who was the permanent undersecretary of state for air. I didn't know that. None of our crew knew that. But he gave us a copy of the funeral service for the 50 officers that were shot at Stalag-Luft 3. And they,
including his son.
His son was one. And then he gave us each a picture of our aircraft. And then I went out to see his wife and his and the skipper's twin sister. And then when I got back to the hotel, there was a telegram recalling me off leave. And the next day, I went back to Bournemouth and over to Southampton on board ship and away home.
Did you, after your 2 years or so confinement, all of a sudden you're thrust back, you know, into freedom, and you come home to Canada. After, did you sort of experience any changes in your personally or personality-wise?
Yes, I think it was fairly universal amongst returning prisoners of war. That they had difficulty adjusting.
Like special difficulties that maybe regular troops that were not prisoners might not encounter?
I think that's true. I think this has been documented various times. In my own case, we met with other people that had been prisoners, and we spent a lot of time drinking beer and
almost like a therapeutic type of
yes, and I hadn't thought of it in that light, but yes, I think that's probably true. Where I had apprenticed, they wanted me to go back to work. I couldn't go back to work. I wasn't ready to go back to work. I bashed around. I registered for university, and I didn't go. It was a strange. I used to go for long walks by myself at night, in fact, I was picked up by police one time for wandering around the district at 3 o'clock in the morning. And they wanted to know what I was doing.
Well, it's bad enough being picked up by German authorities when you were in Canadian authorities.
But it was a strange business because you couldn't seem to adjust. In any case, I went back to work at the drugstore, and I registered in medicine, I guess, and then I didn't go. And everybody kept asking me what I was going to do, and I've heard this from other people. People say, "What are you going to do?" I didn't know what you were going to do. And in the event, I worked in the sawmill in British Columbia. Then finally, I pulled myself together and I registered at the university and went into pharmacy.
Well, Mr. Taylor, this has certainly been an enjoyable conversation for me, and obviously your experience during the war is somewhat unique in that not every person who was involved in that war had the misfortune to be taken as a POW, and I would just like to thank you for your time and your trouble.
You said misfortune. I think my feeling is that in many cases we were the fortunate ones. There were lots of them didn't have the chance to become prisoners. They were killed. And, I lost a lot of friends that way.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Taylor, as I say, I appreciate your time and your effort and your trouble for being interviewed. I thank you very much.
No problem.